All right, hello and welcome to the episode. Welcome to the episode. Welcome to the At You Two podcast. Episode number 46 is what my brain was thinking, but I forgot about the first part of that sentence, where we talk all things U2, album news and tour dates, not quite yet, but rumored, and community discussions from the staff of At You Two. Of course, we're doing our album by album discussion, and we're landing on All That You Can't Leave Behind this episode. But first, we must meet our guests, our co-hosts that we didn't leave behind. I've got Sherry back on the show. Hello, Sherry.
Hey, you know what I realized for 2017? I can't sing, but I've got soul.
And Marilyn's back as well.
Hi, everybody.
Hey, Marilyn. And Ian?
Hello.
And last but not least, Tasula.
It's Tasula right here, and I have prepared to let you all know there's nothing you can throw at me that I haven't already heard.
Nicely done.
I agonized over that. Like, I was going through lyrics all day yesterday. I'm not even kidding.
Sounds like a challenge.
When two of you skipped it, yeah.
Well, last episode, I said, if you're going to be on from now on, you got to have a album-specific quote or quip or pun or something by way of introducing yourself. So, Sherry, okay. Sherry, set the bar.
But here's mine. I'm hot as a hairdryer in your face.
That's a good one.
There you go. All right, yes, we're on All That You Can't Leave Behind.
You're rolling right past yourself. Do you have a...
I don't. I'm just the intro guy. I don't, I don't have to think.
Immune.
Yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh. I think he would admit that big girls are best, Tasula. He's not going to have a quip. I'll supply one for him.
You may want to prepare in the future.
Yeah, I'll probably be prepared next time. I almost forgot about that single or B-side or whatever. That's a funny one.
Great song.
Yeah. Okay, but before we get to the album, we're just going to do a bit of miscellaneous discussion. There's been a bit of... first of all, there's a post on atu2.com. If you are inclined to help us out with things like puns and editing articles and writing articles and sharing things and all sorts of U2 stuff, the At U2 crew is looking for more of us, I guess. We're being replaced, maybe? I don't know. Are we being phased out? Is this...
It's like when you see your job posted on a board,
yeah,
before you've been told. We know.
Yeah.
We just want to get more people, not less people.
Right. Other than podcast editor wasn't listed as a job, right?
Yeah. Okay. Your position is safe, okay, maybe. Yeah. The rest of us are in danger.
Matt hasn't fired me. You check out the post on atut.com. The link will be in the show notes, which you can find at goodstuff.fm/atu2/46. We're up to, I think. Is that right? And also a bit of tour news. Who wants to share? Somebody wants to just gloss over in a brief way, because by the time folks listen to this, they might have more details already. But
let's put it this way. If you are not already a subscriber to U2.com, and if you have not already updated your mailing address or renewed your subscription, now is the time to do it. Do not pass go. Do not collect your $200. Go and do it, because we are anticipating within the next week or less a tour announcement surrounding the Joshua Tree's 30th anniversary. There's rumors that they're going to be doing a brief stadium jaunt between the U.S. and Europe. All information will be announced very, very shortly. These are going to be a special set of gigs. We're anticipating that'll be kind of like Springsteen's The River Tour, but there's no confirmation on that, where we're hoping that they're going to perform the whole album cover to cover in that special set of dates. So more news will be forthcoming. But as I said, if you are a subscriber to U2.com, make sure that you have all of your information updated, because ticket pre-sales may be happening very soon.
Right. So the reason being, like you said, if you subscribe, you get early access right to tickets. Is that sort of the...
Yeah. The main typically benefit? You get like either two tickets to one show in Europe, or two tickets to two shows in the U.S. I don't know what their rules are going to be this time around due to scalpers and all that other stuff, but all information will be announced through the official U2 channels. So don't believe anything unless you see it on U2.com.
Right, exactly. Or hear it at youtube.com is the
which we'll get off of youtube.com.
Exactly. You can trust us, even though we just said not to.
I'm fired for that,
yeah,
aren't I?
Exactly. Can we have a replacement? Sherry's understudy. Someone, I don't know who it is, but Mark Peterborough is doing a YouTube World Cup. Who's typing there that I don't know?
Missoula.
Okay.
I don't know what bird I am or animal I am in Google Docs, but yeah, that's me. And I have a good time lobbying for Volcano on this current World Cup challenge. So all of you join me only if you plan on voting for Volcano and jump in and vote. It's open to everyone.
So hashtag YouTube Millennium Songs is...
That's right.
Where you can sort of track the discussion, or we'll have Mark's Twitter account in the show notes as well. So,
whereas our friend Bethan Bono is really advocating for stand-up comedy. So I'm just saying.
Nice. All right. And a couple of listener questions, follow-up stuff sort of related to the discussion. But at @Joe_Ahoro said, you two going retro and looking back, celebrating Joshua Tree. Strange, isn't it? Thought they always wanted to look forward, which is interesting to do because Bono, you know, famously has sort of said, you know, if we stare at the past too long, we'll dry up and all that kind of stuff. And but obviously, in their older age, I guess maybe they're and or wanting some money for retirement. They're happy to look back and
or
celebrate.
Maybe Live Nation wants some money.
Yeah, exactly. So
I'm
we'll
not
see.
Cynical.
Yeah, and also at the Edge 1980, Welcome to the Future said how to get in touch with the band and our management regarding what the band is up to. I have a fan letter for them. We at U2.com, despite having U2 in our domain name, we don't have any direct connection to U2. Unfortunately, there's the Zootopia forum. On U2.com maybe is one place to post something if you're hoping to get in touch with them, or obviously tweeting at them might be another way, but we don't have any direct connections that we're able to use in that way. So all the best. We do get people emailing us and asking us to get in touch with them, special requests and things like that, but unfortunately we don't have that kind of information. So
yeah, so if you want them to play at your wedding, yeah, or you want Bono to leave a voicemail message for your mother, we are not the people to turn to on that.
Yeah, exactly.
If you want to have a collaboration with U2 and you have lyrics to submit, we're not necessarily the best place for that.
Exactly. We might run off with them for the At U2 band and make our own songs if you send us good lyrics anyway. So anyways, moving along. I was just thinking the heartbreaking ones are the ones that where it's like somebody is sick and they want to get in touch with Bono and you're like, I really wish I could help you. That would be awesome. No. That sounds amazing and I wish you all the best. But we just have no way of doing it. So anyways, moving on. We're going to jump right into our At U2 Roundtable, which is our discussion of the album All That You Can't Leave Behind. By way of introduction, if this is your first episode of the podcast you happen to be jumping into, we've been doing Boy to Songs of Innocence, or whatever may happen here this year. Going back, starting with episode number 34 at goodstuff.fm/ATU2/34 with Boy, of course. And we find ourselves now at All That You Can't Leave Behind. So, Sherry, I think you'd thrown in some notes as far as what giving us a bit of context for where they were at. This is from U2 by U2, the mammoth book that was out a few years ago. But do you want to give us some highlights as far as what was going on when they were recording the album?
Yeah, sure. Bono was having one of those moments where everything was happening around him. So he had a cancer scare himself where he had to go in for a throat biopsy. It came back negative, but it started to put things into focus for him, because at around the time when the recording sessions began for this, he found out that his father had cancer. Michael Hutchins, one of his BFFs, had an untimely death. His wife, Allie, was pregnant with Elijah at the time. Edge and Morley were also expecting. There was just a lot going on in his life where he kind of felt like, you know, whether it's a father dying or a friend dying or a new life coming in into the world. He said it seemed like a moment to make an album about essential things. He wanted an emotionally raw record about real life and responsibilities that come with that life and the joy of just being alive and being awake. and just the scare of not being able to sing again, he decided that he just wasn't going to mess around. We're also looking at his side project, The Million Dollar Hotel, was in script development, in movie production, and then there was the soundtrack that went along with that. That was going on at the same time, and of course, as everybody knows, that was really the start of Bono's advocacy work on behalf of Jubilee 2000, which then turned into the One Campaign and Data and all of that stuff. So Larry has been quite vocal about that type of work and how it impacted the band and its ability to function, but it didn't impact the creativity or the quality of the recording process. But it was starting to play heavily in the band relationships as they're seeing people like George W. Bush and Jesse Helms, and these are some of the people who don't necessarily subscribe to the other band members' way of thinking, let alone Bono's. So it started creating a little bit of a fracture within the band, but it wasn't obviously anything that would cause the band to break up. So it was a very interesting time. Plus, they were coming off of Pop and Pop Mart, and they sort of needed to dream it up all over again, and that's what they successfully did with this album.
Yeah, and wasn't there's also a story of like Bono losing lyrics again for the, you think by now, or stolen or something, I forget.
Oh, it was, wasn't that the set that was in Nice when they were doing the swimming pool photo shoot or something?
Yeah.
Is this the right album? Yeah, I guess it would have been. It would have been this. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and it's a fun, great album coming out of all that stuff that, you know, was going on. And I remember being, as a fan, not really aware. And all of a sudden there's this Million Dollar Hotel soundtrack and you're like, what is this? And where, how does that fit with everything? And some really good songs on there, which someday we'll cover maybe if we ever finish discussions. But at Kevin S.
Will we talk about that before Passengers?
Yeah, I don't know.
Or will Passengers come first?
B-sides and other albums will be, well, soundtracks, I don't know.
We'll, Songs of Experience will be done
yeah.
before that.
I'm not so certain at this point.
At Kevin STU said, could you consider adding discussion of the outtakes for the podcast for All That You Can't Leave Behind? And U2 War 40 said, these sessions have the second best batch of leftovers. Levitate, Love You Like Mad, Summer Rain, Always Flower Child, and Ground Beneath Her Feet. Not quite Joshua Tree and Rattle and Hum, but solid. And I would just definitely second that.
Yeah, me too.
We won't be going through every single outtake. And that's, again, a discussion for another podcast someday. But they were released officially as part of, I think it was the bundle of every single U2 song at the time that iTunes did. They had a deal.
And a lot of those were also released as part of the 7 CD that was available at Target stores in the US.
Right. Yeah.
I have one of those for sale if anyone would like to buy my extra.
All right. No time like the present.
At Sula.
Yeah.
On Twitter.
Yeah.
And someone threw it in the notes here, but just briefly, the naming of it, there is that. I remember learning this too, the passage in the Bible, Joshua 3, where is that here? Joshua 33:3 or whatever, which is also possibly was.
Well, this one here, the passage in Corinthians was where the album title came from. The Joshua or the Jeremiah 33:3 was the reference on the album cover,
right. Yeah, on the album
that
cover.
Bono calls it to be God's phone number, as it says, call unto me and I will answer thee great and mighty things which thou knowest not. But the actual naming of the album came from the Corinthians passage about a house going on fire, and it seems to suggest that when in death we eventually face judgment, that all that is made of straw and wood would be burned away and only eternal things will survive. So that bonfire of the vanities, and as you throw anything you want on the fire, whatever you want more than love, it has to go. And the phrase, all that you can't leave behind, is at the end of Walk On.
Yeah. Someone, again, Anonymous Fruit is writing or something, and that this is U2's first digital album. Oh, Ian is writing that, which is a good point, actually. Ian, do you want to go with your comment?
Sure. Yeah. Because with Pop Mart, I remember they had like kind of a peekaboo camera where you could see them recording the album and stuff like that. But with All You Can't Leave Behind, they for a while had a proto website, which was just this kind of schematic of a house with rooms. And as you'd go through the rooms, you could hear little snippets of the songs. And they also released a special bonus. This was back when the website was free, when you didn't have to pay to be a member. They released a little thing that you could add on to your PC, and this little U2 dirigible would show up on your screen and toss out All That You Can't Leave Behind suitcases that would bounce to the bottom of the screen. And this was the first album where the entire thing was available online for download before it was available for purchase. And I remember at the time, Edge and Bono thought that was really cool. I don't know if they've changed their mind since then. But
they didn't have an ET moment with Apple at that point.
Yeah,
did they?
Exactly. Yeah, I just remember being in the computer lab at school, and I found them. I forget what was hosting them, but I just downloaded them all. And it was the first time I had ever downloaded tracks and made an album out of them digitally. And it was all very, very cool. Really enjoyed it. It really set the tone for what was coming. And also, they had the first number one song in iTunes, if I remember correctly, with Stuck in a Moment You Can't Get Out Of. That was the acoustic version. There was the first number one track that was on iTunes after it started selling tracks rather than just playing pre-existing audio files.
Right. Yeah, when they the sort of infamous of like allowing people to buy cherry pick songs instead of just or singles or whatever, instead of having to buy the full album, and the debate that ensued, and obviously won out. So, and again, someone else is right. The pre-tour, I remember the tour. This was sort of where like the band, infamously reapplying for the job of the best band in the world, and all that kind of stuff that Bono keeps doing over and over. But they definitely seem to be like, okay, we're going to really promote this. We're not going to sort of be cheeky about it and go to Kmart or whatever this time, but we're actually going to go and do like the promotional circuit that they seem to sort of not do in past album releases anyways, as definitely not to the degree that they did with this album. I don't know who wrote that and who wants to come on.
That would be the anonymous penguin. Okay. or whoever I'm popping up as. Yeah, they did, it was a handful of shows between Europe and the U.S. They did Farm Club. They did a where they would play for about an hour, mostly the new stuff. And it was really the first time in over a decade that they poured resources into the pre-promotion for the album before it was released on what was it, October 30th or 31st of 2000. If you go to our tours area on at U2, you can look up all of the pre-tour information. But I just remembered, you know, they really flooded all available avenues to promote this album in a way that they hadn't done since the 80s, which signaled to me at least that they knew that they had a lot of ground to make up after what they were going through between, you know, 1994 to 2000. They lost a lot of ground in the U.S. marketplace specifically. And then to have the strength of Beautiful Day at the Grammys, which I'm sure that we'll talk about later on, that really catapulted everything. But yeah, this was the first time where whoever wanted to talk with them, they accepted interviews, which surprised many, many people.
Yeah, I remember they played TRL on MTV. I think it was probably the last.
Yeah,
the last
from the rooftop of MTV Studios. Yeah.
With Carson Daly, I think it was probably the last time they ever played live on MTV. But yeah.
They did still seem to do a lot of their promo stuff with a bit extra of like style. It wasn't just sort of going through the motions. I remember the SNL Saturday Night Live appearance where they, you know, Bono went out into the crowd. I think that's the year that time. The
best. Yeah. He played three songs that night.
Yeah, and I remember reading like about it through, I forget if it was Amy Poehler's book or Tina Fey's.
That was November 21st, 2004. I happen to know that because it was the night of my birthday party. So that was before How to Dismantle. And I dragged everyone from my birthday party so we could watch it together. Gotcha. Sorry to interrupt. Go
ahead. They did play SNL this time, but yeah, I'm mixing up the performances of the.
But they did play before for this album as well. But Val Kilmer was the host and it wasn't the one where Amy Poehler danced with him did an extra song.
Okay. That was probably the last time Val Kilmer was on TV as well.
I'm afraid you might be right. So I love him.
Yes, Danny. He's a great Batman. Okay, beautiful day. Let's get into the song by song discussion because we tend to go quite a bit longer.
We didn't talk about the album cover.
Oh, I thought we mentioned the J33, but the airport. Yeah,
but the airport. So apparently there's a. There's a place you can go to actually, you know, look at where they actually filmed this and everything. And there's a window that you look out of to see where they filmed Beautiful Day. And I was in Paris on a layover. That wasn't my destination, but I was in Paris on a layover during a work trip last year, actually about a year ago this week. And I was determined, of course, to go see all this and everything, and take silly pictures and, you know, lay down on the carousel and all that stuff with an apple in my mouth. And, I somehow ended up past security, God knows how, without a boarding pass, because I was doing the electronic boarding pass thing on my phone, which is much more convenient, and I got from Scotland to Paris with no problem because I had that boarding pass, but when I got to Paris, the phone had nothing else, and so I asked for directions to the U2 site, which they know people look for. And they're like, oh, that's over in 2F or whatever, blah, blah, blah. And in my rudimentary French, I was like, can I go there? I have like an hour to kill between, you know, now and my flight, but my flight's in this terminal. And they were like, well, as long as you have a boarding pass, sure. And I was like, oh, son of a bee, you know? So I had to run and get a boarding pass replaced. And then I stopped at Starbucks, my fault, because I saw that they have a pistachio rose latte, and it's my thing in every new country to try a new drink in every new country. So I got
priorities.
I know, right? I am a horrible fan. So I got my Starbucks, and it was like 5 o'clock in the morning, so you have to cut me some slack there. But anyway, so by the time that I got my boarding pass redone by somebody that was not very polite in the airport, it was time to go to my own gate. So there's your whole story. But for those fans who are in Charles de Gaulle Airport on a regular basis, they usually are very helpful at pointing out where you need to go to look at that stuff. That's why I wanted to tell the story.
So you can recreate. I'm sure folks, people who've listened already have done that, recreated the photo in some form or another from the album cover. And so if you have done that, tweet at us at U2 or iChris, or use the hashtag AskAtU2 and throw a link to your Instagram photo of it or wherever you happen to put it up on the web, and it'd be cool to see those.
One other thing I wanted to make sure I mentioned was I really love the iconography for this album going off the cover art. Each song had its own symbol, and they had a bunch of additional symbols set up for the album. Like Peace on Earth was a dove, and Walk On was the Amnesty International sign, and Beautiful Day had both a sun and a rocket ship flying around the world. And I just really, really like the thought and care they put into the visual appearance of the album as a whole and the individual tracks. Each one had its own kind of design and thought put into it. And I haven't really seen that a whole lot with any of their other albums. And it still is one of the coolest things about this album, I think.
I do remember a funny story about this artwork, which Steve Avril and Sean McGrath told back at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, whatever year they came to speak. What was it, 2003? It was a long, long time. Yeah, it was 2003, because this would have been the current album at the time. And they told a funny story about when they first showed a draft of this artwork to the band. They liked it, but Larry was like, I don't want any girly hearts. And then the stage turned into a heart. So we don't have to. But I just thought that was a great moment.
Yeah, but the stage wasn't a girly heart, though. That's the thing.
Right. It had edge to it. It was
It was a very manly man heart.
Jeez. Larry. Okay, speaking of Larry, let's go on. I don't know, that's a terrible segue, but let's go on to Beautiful Day. We're going to do our album, or song by song now, discussion of the album.
We are doing an album by album. You're not wrong.
Amazing.
I think that this was a great way to start this album after the whole pop storyline that I didn't really know that pop storyline until I started listening to this album and I started listening to pop and this album around the same time. So what a switch. So completely different, but can anybody ever imagine their life without this song in it? I mean, this is just such a monster song for, I think, for the band and for all the fans. This is the perennial favorite during the live shows. Everybody sings and dances during this one. I love this video. I remember seeing this video of Michael Stipe and Mario Batali. Have you guys ever seen this?
Yes.
I love this video. And Michael Stipe is dancing like a crazy kook. I'm gonna put it in the and he is dancing like a crazy man, and at some point he shouts, "I wish I had written this song." And I think every time I hear this song, I hear Michael Stipe in my head saying, "I wish I had written this song." And I absolutely love it. It's just probably is this their biggest hit from this album?
Oh yeah.
Is it?
Edge says it's their biggest hit ever, just as far as overall radio play and public awareness and all that.
Well, and the fact that it won 3 Grammy Awards, Record of the Year, Song of the Year, and Best Rock Performance by a Duo or Group with Vocal at the 2001 Grammys.
Deservingly so.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So So this was a great start for them to on their resume to be the best band in the world again, or biggest band in the world. What was it that they said they
wanted? Yeah,
I think applying
for the job, biggest and best.
Yeah,
yeah, I think that was an excellent choice.
# comeback.
Yeah.
They needed it.
Yeah. Yes, they did. They did.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those songs that's like a monster song that it sounds timeless and feels like it's been there forever. It's also a crazy fun song to play on guitar. And as much of this album, it's kind of like the pop was the disappearance. Europa and pop are kind of disappearance of Edge theoretically. And this album's definitely the return of the Edge in many ways. So let's keep on moving to Stuck in a Moment.
Stuck in a Moment is a song that most will point to as being the tribute that Bono wrote for Michael Hutchence, the lead singer of NXS, who had died unexpectedly. But what's interesting about this song is that it's one of the first ones out of the early recording sessions that the band really hooked on to. Edge said in U2 that Brian Eno had set the piece off when Edge performed the piano into a sequencer. Eno then took it and eliminated the first and second notes and just kept every third note, which he then set into a different keyboard with a heavy treatment on it. So it gives an otherworldly effect over what is quite a traditional gospel piano experience. Bono's voice also being what it was at the time, they were quite pleased with how his vocals sounded on it. And Bono wanted it to be written in a way that wasn't sappy or wasn't very poppy. Larry had said that the verses needed to be much tougher. And with the opening line of the song, Bono felt that Michael deserved a lyric that wasn't sentimental, that it needed to sound the way that two friends would talk with one another. And I think that the song achieves what they set out to do.
Yeah, definitely. It's and Zahara Sarah in the chat room says, is it wrong to say I'm tired of hearing this lot? They play it so much in Australia, which is kind of interesting. I don't hear it a lot on the radio here. It's I can definitely, I guess maybe because of the Michael Hutchins connection, they play it a lot more there. But again, this is another one that I'll be the token guitar guy, I guess. But it's a fun one to play. If you have an acoustic, it's a fun one to play with a band. And it's kind of like the soulful version of U2 that you don't get to hear a lot of, that comes out in this song that I really dig about it. So,
they played it at Dreamforce too. We should mention.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was beautiful.
Well, so do you normally play, the full version or the acoustic version? Cause I remember when the acoustic version showed up on U2-7 and it just kind of like totally helped me reimagine my interpretation of the song. Edge's work on it is just so beautiful.
Yeah, that's definitely, and I can't say claim to be as proficient as Edge is. I tend to be more thick fingered with my chords, but definitely
keep it clean.
Yeah, but it's the acoustic version definitely helps. Sort of like, I guess that's where I prefer the alternate versions, whether it's live and in stadium or whatever they happen to be, or yeah, that acoustic version definitely is more. I feel tired in a way of the single version, the album version, but it's not that I skip it, I guess, when it comes on. So don't send me hate letters. But all right, let's keep moving to Elevation.
Oh, yeah.
Did you see me pogoing in my living room?
Yes, I was also pogoing in my living room. Although my daughter's asleep on the floor, so I had to kind of jump over her. So when I went to see the Elevation tour, I was also pregnant. very, very pregnant. Just a couple of weeks out from having my son. And he was a big fat baby, so he didn't move around much inside. But when we went to the show, as soon as they launched into Elevation, he started to kick me. And that's funny to you. So I can never listen to this song and not think about him. If you could have seen a foot stick out of my stomach, that's what it would have looked like a cartoon, like cartoon feet coming out. That's what it would have looked like. So so this was my son's first concert, and he's a huge U2 fan. He loves this album and he loves this song. So I'd like to thank the band for that.
So he was the mole digging up your soul?
Yes, literally.
What did everybody think about the Tomb Raider themed video for this one?
That's what I was just trying to remember.
Evil Bono.
Yeah. It's apparently, according to Wikipedia, cited as one of the most expensive music videos ever filmed. And I can't even remember it right now, which is terrible.
Oh, it's Angelina Jolie. And my favorite thing is when they're talking about the footage of the making of it, when they tell Larry not to react to the explosion. And the first time it goes off, he just bursts out laughing. it's like one of my favorite Larry moments in the history of U2. It's so cute. So
I often wonder. Go watch it. I often wonder if he's thinking, you call that a kaboom?
I just like how they start with, hello, Bono. This is Evil Bono.
Yes.
And then you see Evil Bono's rubber legs flying above normal Bono. It's just so bad. That's so bad.
It's awful, but it's hilarious. And you know, Edge is just so into it. Edge looks like the perfect person for that.
Oh, yeah. He twitches his head with Laura Croft. And
yes.
Then There's that elephant flying over.
Right. That's probably why it was so expensive.
Which is worse. Yeah. This video or the football version of Stuck in a Moment?
Well, in the football version of Stuck in a Moment, you at least get to see Larry happy, so.
True.
Yeah, what's with you two and videos, man? It's like they're either really good or just really bad. I don't know. I got some issues there, I guess, but in spite of it all. All right, let's keep moving on to Walk On.
Well, one thing I would like to say is...
You are Russian, Chris. Sorry.
Hey, we always get heck from the boss for being a 16-hour podcast, so...
He's not on here. This one. And we have an extra person, so budget more time, right?
Sorry, go ahead, Ian.
I know this song gets a lot of grief for its lyrics and for its chorus being basically just utter nonsense, but it's just fun. It's awesome to bounce to live. It just gets people's energy up, and yeah, people who complain about it, yeah, it's just fun. I'm not allowed to say what I want to say. It's just a fun, entertaining, like concert and elevating song, and yeah, just enjoy it for what it is.
I need to get my hands on the single version or whatever, which apparently has more of the live mix that they've done. I always just listen to the album version that I have whenever I listen to this, or also live, you know, concert version. But the single version sounds like it might be a little more my speed, but I haven't actually.
You'd like it. Yeah. I can send it to you.
No, you can't, because that would be illegal, and we do not do illegal.
No, I mean, like, no, you can borrow it through the mail.
Okay.
It would just be a preview copy. It's
right.
A preview
copy. Yeah, I'm not saying, I don't do that, you know. Now,
the influx on the remix is on the Target 7 album. So,
right.
So that's the live version for the Elevation Tour that they walked out on stage for.
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. Gotcha. Okay. Can I go on to Walk On now?
I suppose.
Gee, Dad.
I'm just like excited because I'm hearing it again, and I've listened to it like four times this week, and that's not enough. So I think this is one of those U2 songs that is great on the studio version, and then they have like five other versions that are just as great or better, including the live version. My favorite version is actually the one from America, Tribute to Heroes, where they have the Hallelujah and Peace on Earth at the beginning and Hallelujah at the end. But for the purposes
Whereas
of this,
my favorite version is the one from Raleigh in 2009.
I'm getting to that. You're cutting me off. So I was going to say, the main reason that I love this song so much is it's the only song that I have ever had the pleasure of hearing while on stage with the band. And Sherry was right there with me that night, right next to me, as we volunteered for the whatchamacallit, the masks
International.
Went up. Yeah. Amnesty International, thank you. And one campaign where you'd hold the mask up in the concert. And in Raleigh, North Carolina, where we were, which was actually a really cool venue, one of my favorite venues, because it was a college campus, I believe, and they didn't allow alcohol. So the crowd was awesome, and there was not like drunk people screaming the whole time, but anyway, I digress. Just an amazing, surreal experience to be standing out in front of Bono. Basically, we were kind of at the tip of the stage and feel what he feels, the actual vibrations of the crowd just going nuts, was something I will absolutely never forget.
And so. Larry was right behind you, Tasula.
And Marilyn, my dear friend in the world, actually captured Larry and Bono right behind me in photographs and sent me them immediately, which made my life. So, yes, that was the only regrettable thing is that I was wearing one of Answer Guy's old shirts that night. So I look like I'm about 400 pounds. And I was actually kind of thin back then. So, yeah, so that is a regret, or that I didn't like at least tie a belt around it because it was basically a dress. But I don't care. I don't care what I look like. That moment I will never forget.
What was interesting with this particular song, though, was U2 was given the Freedom of the City Award in Dublin in 2000. And with that award ceremony, one was also given to Aung San Suu Kyi in absence. And at that point, at least according to Edge, the band wasn't aware of who she was or what was going on. And it was because of that award ceremony that they started to look into it and was taken aback by her house arrest and what was going on in Burma. And ultimately that's what inspired this song to be written in the first place.
And the album is dedicated to her as well.
Yeah.
For me, this is probably one of my top five most important U2 songs, because when I was coming out of the closet, this was the song that I would just repeat again and again in my head. Just there's the specific line, "Walk on, what you've got, they can't feel it. They can't steal it. No, they can't even feel it." And I just remember all the times when, I mean, as a young gay man, when people were trying to pass laws against us or like using us as cuss words or stuff like that, just those lines, "Walk on, stay safe tonight, what you've got, they can't steal it. No, they can't even feel it." That stuff was more important. Those words were more important to me than most anything else. And just like keeping my head up and keeping on with the process and coming out to more and more people. This song, I can't say enough about how important it was for me in just getting over that hump in my life and moving on with it.
And when the album was first released, I was still recovering from being laid off by a previous job. And this helped me to basically move on from that utter rejection of being let go, and allowed me to accept wherever I was, at that point in my life. And then to have it transform after what had happened on September 11th, the following year, this became, one of these songs, as DeSula pointed out, with the tribute to heroes, program that had happened, that suddenly the song took on, the hurt of a nation and helped elevate it out of that anger and depression and what do we do. This whole album became America's healer for the most part, and the song played a great deal towards that.
Yeah, I remember that MTV made a specific music video, mm-hmm, showing people like mourning after the 9/11 attacks, mm-hmm, and stuff like that with this song, just because it was so completely appropriate for that moment. And it struck such a perfect chord with people at that time and place.
Yeah, that's awesome. Definitely some heavy stuff and really cool stuff. Thanks for sharing that.
Some really fluffy stuff, DeSula. Yeah.
All, which again, we've said many times as we do this series, is just like the different, many different ways that a song and what feels like could be a simple chord structure and lyric can take on and become for different people in many different situations, in many different places and times around the world, and through history anyways too. So we'll try and link up some of those videos, and obviously you just go on YouTube, you can search for Walk On U2 and find a bunch of the different videos. But even as a Canadian looking down on, or not down literally, but like looking down at the U.S.
We get that you're up north.
You can admit it.
Yeah.
It's okay. I
looking
mean,
down my
everyone
nose.
Everyone else does.
But yeah, that Tribute to Heroes concert or telethon or whatever it was exactly, but just that the version of that song there was just like hit an emotional chord with, I think, anybody. You had to be sort of fairly soulless to not appreciate that. So all right, but moving on, we got to go on to Kite, which at U2War40 said Kite is the best single that never was. The shadow behind your eyes. Who's the sun?
You want to talk about one of the heaviest songs that the band has ever done. Kite ranks right up there. Edge said that it had its origins with a little string loop that he had made. Everybody started playing along, and the song just jumped. It was an amazing one long improv in which the melodies, guitar parts, string sections, drums, the whole thing came together. And Bono said that his voice returned in that moment when he sang, "I'm a man, I'm not a child." Everyone in the studio almost fell over. It was Bono's voice coming back. And this is a song that many will have read that it was about Bono taking Jordan and Eve out to fly a kite. You know, he had been away traveling, and when they took the kite out, it crashed and went to smithereens pretty immediately. But Edge had made the connection that it really wasn't about Bono and his girls. It was about Bono and his dad. That was around the time when his father was diagnosed with cancer, and it wasn't looking good for Bob. Kite is one of those farewell songs. Bono had also said that that when he was singing, he started to think back when he was a child and going to a caravan site in either Rush or Scaries, and remembered that his dad had also tried to do exactly the same thing with a kite and had gone equally badly. He realized he wasn't singing from quite a theoretical place as he thought. He felt the goodbye aspect of the song was not from him to Bob, but from Bob to him. And this is a song that's got sort of a setting in time where you're talking about the last of the rock stars when hip hop drove the big cars, the time when new media was the big idea. That was done intentionally to mark that moment in time and then to leave it behind. So for me, it's such an emotional song that people wanted it performed during the Elevation tour, and he had to be emotionally in that mind space in order to do it. And I remember my friend Kenny when they first performed it in California. It's like midnight Eastern time, and I'm getting I'm a phone call, and I'm like, "Oh," you know, in that midnight voice, half awake, and all I could hear was the band performing Kite. He didn't say a word. He just held up his cell phone. And then as soon as the song was over with, he hung up. I'm like, well, if anybody ever wants to wake me up like that, feel free. It just guts you every time you hear it. And thinking through, you know, when they end up doing Songs of Experience and finally go on tour with it, Kite would probably fit wonderfully in that realm, but I think it's too emotional of a song for them to pull out of their repertoire moving forward.
Yeah, there's in the chat room and then other places too. I think the Kite version that's on the Window in the Skies single, the B-side or whatever, it's on YouTube, and we'll link to it in the show notes and stuff, but is a great version of the song as well. If you're looking for alternate versions of songs just to hear different ways that it's been interpreted over the years, is a great version to sing or listen to. Anyone else with Kite thoughts before we move on? I don't want to cut anybody off like I did last time.
Yeah, I think I heard Bono say, when you are a songwriter, sometimes you're the last one to know what you're on about. I think those were his words when he was talking about this song.
Yeah.
And what you said, Sherry, is exactly right. You know, maybe he was writing it for his dad, but really it was about himself and his family. And the way that this song just resonates with so many people is such a testament to the power of the lyrics and the tune. So when I first got this album, I didn't really love it. It was a slow kind of burn for me to get to love this album. And Kite was the song that really turned me around to loving this album.
To be perfectly frank, I remember hearing the first clip. It was of the chorus when it was still on the YouTube Proto site. And I feel ashamed for saying it now, but I remember thinking, wow, they're doing Bon Jovi better than Bon Jovi does.
Wow.
Yeah. I feel so bad now.
To be fair, you were listening to a clip on a website, and back in the day, it wasn't as high quality as it is these days. It's also one of the few, relatively few times that Edge pulls out the slide guitar, which is a interesting little tidbit for any guitar nerds or whatever out there. But
and the didgeridoo for the live version.
Did he?
Yes.
Oh, there you go. Even more fun trivia, musical instrument trivia, YouTube trivia. So, all right, moving on to In a Little While.
Surely you'll be fine.
Sula back? No.
She'll be back in a little while.
Sorry, I'm
perhaps
here.
Perhaps she was blown by every breeze.
I was on mute because I get scolded for typing, and I was actually trying to tweet out the picture of myself with Bono on my head, but I will wait until I'm done talking about it in a little while.
Did you make a stop at Starbucks too while you're...
No? keep it up, Chris. Just be sure not to cut me off before I'm done. So anyway, so yes, this is my favorite song on the album, and it has a special story, and I won't tell you the whole story because I wrote it in a Laika song, which I'm sure Chris will link to in our show notes. But when this album came out, I was 25, and I was getting ready to go to Dublin for the Slane concerts. I had never been to Ireland by myself. I had been to Ireland before. I'd never been by myself. And before I went, it was important that I got my wisdom teeth out. And that was the first surgery that I had ever had at the time. And I was terrified of it. And I had to have my mom come up and take care of me afterward because I live alone and they wouldn't let me like leave the hospital without somebody, you know, taking care of me or whatever. So anyway, mom came up and stayed with me for like a week to nurse me back to health. And I was in a lot of pain right after the surgery. And I remember just laying on my couch at the time. And she put this album on for me. And I said, just put it on in a little while and put it on repeat. Like, that's all I want to hear. That's what calms me down. That's what comforts me or whatever. She's like, okay. And so she did. And after, you know, 16 versions of this going through, she likes the album and everything. She was fine with it. But she said, you know, honey, something that I've always done, anytime that I've been in an incredible amount of pain or been in a really awful situation, I just think, you know, tomorrow at this time, it won't hurt as bad, or I won't feel this way. I'll feel a lot better. And that like totally stayed with me for whatever reason. Like it was a good psychological game for me that anytime, not just when I'm recovering from surgery or have something physical that's actually giving me physical pain, that if I'm in a bad place, it will get better. You know, that's the moral of the story. And so I equate this song with that lesson that I got from my own mother.
Very cool. And the chat room is mentioning, and I think someone was going to mention as well, but just the connection that this song had with Joey Ramone. And how and the Vertigo Tour, or sorry, not the Vertigo Tour, the Elevation Tour. Bonner introduces it on the DVD as being the last song apparently that Joey Ramone heard on his deathbed, and so it's kind of changed it for him to being a gospel song from sort of a rock song. And so just wanted to make sure we mentioned that because the chat room would be mad if we didn't.
No, it's actually very notable.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And the reason why the vocal is so raspy is because it was done after a great deal of drink and a rough night.
Which I love that.
It's perfect for the song. Yeah, it kind of just
sure,
needs that.
Sure, exactly.
Yeah.
It's about a hangover. I mean, that's the beauty of it.
Yeah.
Such a poignant song.
So I was at the Portland Elevation show. I remember it was April 15th because it was tax day 2001. And it was just a really awesome Elevation show. I was at Tacoma a few days before. Tacoma was my first.
I was at the Tacoma show too.
Yes. Tacoma was my first U2 show ever. And so, yeah, followed up with Portland a couple days later. And I remember they had their second break. Their second intermission was kind of long, and they come out and Bono just looked really kind of stressed. And I remember him saying that Joey Ramone died today, and obviously they played in a little while earlier. He started into Amazing Grace, and those two songs I've always associated with U2's relationship with the Ramones, in a little while and Amazing Grace. And, it just, that moment at that concert was, you could see how much the Ramones meant to them. And I think it wasn't until a few days later that they found out that Joey had actually died listening to this song.
Yeah.
But you could see just how much it hurt them as a band and how important the Ramones were to them in their history.
Yeah. Very cool. And that's definitely something that's, you know, obviously with Songs of Experience or Songs of Innocence, right, kicking off with the Ramones as well, tribute and, carries over throughout the band's history and definitely for Bono. And it's a very cool moment that you got to be a part of. And luckily, terrible pun. Luckily, you weren't stuck there. So we're going to keep going with Wild Honey. Oh, no fate on that, I guess.
My shelter and my shade.
Didn't Bono say he wrote this song to keep people from jumping off the ledge while listening to this?
Yeah, album? I remember Adam said in an interview, the whole album is about death, so we felt we had to put something in there to like make him not like feel utterly morose and despondent. Yeah, I kind of feel like I want to defend U2 songs that are a little bit lighter and happier and goofier, like Some Days Are Better Than Others off Europa, and yeah, just stuff like that. But this is one of those where it's a light, poppy, fluffy song. It's nothing but foam and air, but it's just so happy and easygoing and doesn't have a care in the world. And there's a specific line in it. I pick flowers for your hall. There's something about that. It's a short line, but I love the imagery of it. And yeah, I do like this song in spite of what everybody else says, and I will happily defend it.
For me, this is the September 10th, 2001 song.
Exactly.
You know, this is before, all hell breaks loose, and I think that it's appropriate that it's placed right before Peace on Earth.
Yeah, it's an interesting perspective. I've never really been able to figure out where or why this song fits in terms of stuff, but I guess, yeah, looking at it in the sort of larger album perspective and just as a lighter moment in the midst of everything else, because I don't think of, and maybe again this is speaking as the non-American in the group, but you know, it is definitely connected with September 11th, but it's not like completely in the same way that emotionally it seems to be for the rest of you, and which is understandable. And so it doesn't feel like as heavy an album in that sense to me, but, so I could never really sort of get my head around where Wild Honey was going at. It didn't seem like a very U2-y kind of song, but I won't fight you, Ian, on it. It's not that.
Trust me. It's worth listening to.
Edge said that he always thought of it as a bit obla-di, obla-da.
Yeah, that's exactly, yeah. That's sort of where I'm at with it too. But it's one of those ones where if I'm close enough to my MP3 player or whatever I'm listening to, I might actually skip it. Shocker of shockers. But if I'm not, it's not worth getting up to go skip.
I will say it is a fun song live.
What is worth it to get out of your chair to go? That's what I want to know.
Chris, from thousands of miles away, I'm slapping your hand away. Don't you dare fast forward through it.
Fast forward. That's even an older chair. Sorry. There we go. Old school. Yeah.
Now, I will say that this is one of those fun songs. I was lucky enough to be at Larry's 40th birthday party at Providence, although it really wasn't a party, it was a concert, but we all considered it a party. And they pulled this one out mid show, and it was just everybody's, you know, swinging along and just having a nice lighthearted moment. Every so often you need a bit of sorbet to clean the palate, and that's what this one is.
Nice. Yeah. All right, Peace on Earth.
Say that what you mark will surely overtake you, and you become a monster, so the monster will not break you. And it's already gone too far. You said that if you go in hard, you won't get hurt.
When Peace on Earth was recorded, the band all felt that it was one of those pour your heart out songs. Edge said it's bleak, but it's real. And it came together very easily. You know, this is a reaction from U2 about the bombings that had happened in Oma, you know, at the end of the song, Bono's naming off some of the, victims who lost their life through the senseless violence that had happened there. It's the first time in a long time that Bono, you know, wrote about his time on Cedarwood Road and talking about the violence of his youth. I sort of see Peace on Earth as a part of the trinity of Sunday Bloody Sunday, Please, and then Peace on Earth. This is like, you know, you're in that last third of your life, and you just look back and be like, guys, violence doesn't work. This doesn't work. And I love the fact that they put in there, you know, we say it every Christmas time, you know, hope and history won't rhyme. What's it worth? It's really poignant now. I know that I wrote about this in one of my last OTR columns that, you know, this song resonates today. It resonated this past Christmas. Everything that this song is written about is still happening. 16 years later, and it probably will be still happening in another 16 years. Edge was concerned about the cynicism in it. He said, there's one line he was never sure about, the I'm sick of hearing again and again that there's going to be peace on earth. He felt it was too negative. He thought it should have been, I'm sick of hearing again and again that there's never going to be peace on earth. You know, it's just one of those songs. I don't think that's ever been performed live. Maybe just beginning. A little snippet, yeah. You know, just a little snippet. But it's just like, it's another one of those wake up calls. And I think out of all of the songs on this album, I think this one's the darkest one out of everything on this album.
So I think for me, it's a direct response to Wake Up Dead Man. Just because Wake Up Dead Man is kind of this minor key, plaintive, aching, scared, like begging of Jesus to come back, to come save people, to the point where they even use like the same kind of lyric structure. Listen as hope and peace try to rhyme. And then in this one, Bono uses the same kind of structure, but hope and history won't rhyme. And in both of them, he's very specifically saying, wake up, dead man. Jesus, can you take the time to throwing drowning man a line? for me, coming off of pop and then going into All That You Can't Leave Behind, they're two sides of the same coin. I know people like to say, oh, pop is their most like intense, heavy album ever, and All That You Can't Leave Behind is throwaway and tissue paper. But for me, they are it's day and night on the same planet. And these two songs so relate to each other, and to the point where he actually uses the same rhyme structure and with the word rhyme. It's a much heavier song and a much heavier album than I think people give it credit for.
I love that connection, Ian.
Yeah, it's a good one. There's lyrics too in there that obviously sort of became a theme of much of what, whether it was U2 or just Bono's sort of mantras of becoming a monster so the monster will not break you, and that was often repeated as well outside of the context of this song, but obviously, you know, came out of or was inspired by the song or whatever. And it's one of those sort of beautiful simple songs musically that just allows Bono's vocal to sort of soar, whether the lyrics are where you're at or not, but just the emotion that he's able to get across in the song. Obviously, like Sherry said at the end of the song, listing off, you know, names of people and immortalizing them, as it were, in the song, and something that, you know, a band doesn't do lightly, I don't think, you know, something like that, putting people's names within a song. And obviously the importance of doing that, I guess, is reflected by that fact. So I always appreciate the song and love any chance for you two to be a bit more on the emotional, stripped down, kind of simple side of their rock outfit, as they are the biggest band in the world while doing it. So
this could be another song that they could use to highlight the refugee crisis.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
Sure.
Yeah, certainly could. There's a lot of hidden gems that they could pull out, you know, in the next tour here, depending on what happens and how it all sounds and all that kind of stuff. But a lot of stuff that fans of, you know, smaller songs that don't get played as much could definitely look forward to hearing if they went a certain direction with them. So moving on, let's go to When I Look at the World.
So this song gives me a lot to work with in regards to the album. I remember they were saying that they were trying to make an album full of singles, not something that would necessarily communicate itself as a whole, but each song could potentially be released as a single. And when I look at this song, it seems like it's the most well-crafted, well thought out song on the entire album. It doesn't really mesh with the rest of the content of the album. Most of the songs are about outward expression and about generosity or love or patience or what have you. This song is very narcissistic and self-doubting and neurotic, but just listening to how the guitars are played at the end, how the bridge is structured, and I don't think people give bridges enough credit for how important they are to a song when they're good. This one has a really awesome bridge, and you hear Edge's like really solid, heavy guitar behind all the synths that are playing during the verses. And at the end, when you have the vocals with, I think it sounds to me like Daniel Lanois is singing with them, the tell me, what do you see? Tell me what's wrong with me. This song seems very much a piece to itself within the album, and it seems like it has more thought and attention put into it than pretty much anything else on the album.
Yeah, it's sonically, for me, it's a weird one that doesn't seem to fit within, and that's sort of what you're getting at too, is it's a different sound than what the rest of the album sort of feels like, either straight ahead rock songs kind of, or like the Peace on Earth kind of sound stripped back. But definitely the ending of the song has always felt stronger to me than the beginning, and feels like one of those songs like maybe they didn't quite land right on how it was going to be played. And or started anyways. And so that's why it never was played live either. And so U2War 48 commented saying, do you guys buy that Edge forgot how to find the sounds for When I Look at the World, so they couldn't play it live, which I hadn't heard that, but it seems a little bit unlike the Edge to do that, but you never know. And yeah. Ewan Young in the chat room said, When I Look at the World is all that you can't leave behind is Acrobat. Play it live.
Yeah, I'd rather hear this.
Okay. Let's not resurrect the Acrobat argument. Right. What's your,
I think they played a snippet of it in Omaha, and other than that, yeah, nothing.
I'm looking that up. I want verification. I like this. I really like this.
You can trust me. Trust me.
I'm sure you're right, but I just want my own benefit. Songs performed. Here we go. Tours.u2.com.
There you go.
All right.
All right.
So while Tasula's looking that up, the lyric at the end about being in the hospital waiting room and all the smoke and all that stuff, Bono said in U2 that connects his mother and his father. That the last time he was in the waiting room in a hospital was when he was 14, presumably when his mother passed, and that he was amazed at the conclusion of writing this song, that actually came out, that you know, here we have songs about him and his father and reconciling with the losses that have happened and the future loss that would be happening of his dad, and he was still able to tie in his mom into the lyric, which was also interesting. And I do have a confession about When I Look at the World. For me, this is where the album ends. I do not believe that New York or Grace belong as part of the cohesive album. Start to finish, the album runs beautifully from Beautiful Day up to When I Look at the World. And then I just think that the album's over with. And then I'm like, oh, here comes the B-sides.
You have a child named Grace.
Yeah, but
I was just saying it after my Lord. Song.
Come on, Grace. It's a name for a girl, but it's also a thought that could change the world. I mean,
you're jumping the gun.
I'm
not there yet.
And I have to disprove Ian, unfortunately. I looked it up, and it was snippeted on the third leg of Elevation, November 27th, 2001, the city, Kansas City, Missouri.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
Where's my buzzer?
Right church, wrong pew.
Yeah.
I knew it existed, though.
You were right. They did do it. Yeah.
That's why we have tours.atu2.com.
That's
right. So you can cross-check those important references, because somebody in Kansas City would be screaming at their podcast player right now.
We get like a whole Missouri pile of hate mail in the morning.
Exactly.
We just lost a follower.
Okay. I'm sure we did. I'm sure we've lost more than
Matt's
one.
Matt's going to fire somebody over this. Yeah. That's all I have to say.
All right. So let's move on to Sherry. You can, I guess you can just tune out now, right, Sherry?
I'm done.
In New York, I found a friend to drown out the other voices. Voices on a cell phone, voices from home, voices of the hard cell, voices down a stairwell in New York. Just got a place in New York. In New York, summers get hot. Well into the hundreds.
What's the laughing?
The lyrics?
The hair dryer.
Yeah. That's me.
That's Ian's line. Nobody claimed this one. Is it because there's I can't sense the room here. Are we not liking New York, or is it?
It's so silly. I mean, it's not terrible. I don't think it's like their worst song ever, but I just remember it. For me, the memory comes when my sister and I actually went to New York to stand in line for Conan O'Brien on U2, which is a whole other conversation, which I think I brought up before. But anyway, the night before we were supposed to get up and stay in line, they were on Letterman some late night show, and they performed this. And Bono used to do this thing where Statue of Liberty. Yes. And he looked like he was making a turkey sign on his forehead. And my sister and I laughed about this like hours. I mean, we couldn't go to bed. We were laughing. So we're like, what the hell is he doing? I mean, this is ridiculous. Bono. And then he repeated it. Like he went on a different, they played it again, you know, whatever show they were on next. And there comes the turkey. I was like, oh my gosh.
I think he did it on SNL. Actually.
Lady Liberty. I think you're right. Lady
yeah. And
Liberty.
He did it in concert too, which once again, I would like to formally apologize to U2's production people for ruining this song in Providence on Larry's birthday with my birthday balloon. But it wasn't me. Bono let the balloon go up into the rafters and it ended up screwing up the screen that should have come down that would project him to look like the Statue of Liberty so it wouldn't come down. And Dennis Dean, bless his soul, he came over, scratched his head, said, I don't know what the f*** I'm gonna do, and just walked off.
Whoa.
The door is open. We can now say F-box.
Yeah. Potty Mouth McBoston is in the building.
It's going to be
so. Once again, I sincerely apologize for that, but it was not my fault.
You were quoting someone. You were quoting
exactly.
Someone.
And yes. The other thing about New York Live. So, first night in Boston, in 2001. People did not resonate with the song. As a matter of fact, a lot of people used this as their opportunity to sit down. And I knew that they were filming it for the Elevation Live in Boston. And I had the opportunity to yell across the arena to Willie Williams. And I said, it's Boston. We hate New York. It doesn't matter. We hate New York.
The arena was that quiet?
Yeah. Hey, in Boston, we don't like anything New York. So because they were trying to figure out why the audience didn't resonate with this great U2 song. And screw you guys, we're Boston. Don't be singing us about New York.
See, now, I've always thought it was really cool that they had those screens down over the stage on the Elevation shows and kind of the shadows of Bono were projected up against them. But now that I'm thinking of him just trying to be the Statue of Liberty on the screens, it's completely ruined the song for me.
Ridiculous. You have to go back and watch some of that because you will laugh hysterically.
I wish I'd never volunteered for this podcast.
Now we've totally ruined it. Yeah. Hope we haven't ruined it for more of you out there listening.
It definitely, like the chat room is saying, the live version has energy that the album version doesn't. And I feel like it was a well-intentioned musical journey that lyrically they didn't. They settled for location-based lyric instead of, you know, pushing into something more, maybe. But, yeah.
So like Miami on Pop, yeah. New York on All That You Can't Leave Behind, they should just stop naming songs after locations.
No, they do better when they do it metaphorically, like City of Blinding Lights.
Yeah, yep. Exactly. Yep. Yeah, yep. Not going for the literal.
Yeah.
And I think that it made it on the album because they thought it would be a strong live song. As opposed to swapping it out with one of the other B-sides like Summer Rain or Big Girls Are Best, you know?
Well, and you have to admit their timing was prophetic as usual because this came out, you know, Q4 of 2000 and September 11th happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Q4 of 2001. So here we go.
Yeah.
Or Q3.
All right. The final song that Sherry will not be participating in discussion of either.
Yeah, she sure has a lot to say about
it. Is Grace.
And when she walks on the street, you can hear the streams. Grace finds goodness.
So I think that All That You Can't Leave Behind and Pop are very, very intimately tied together. And as I mentioned earlier when I was talking about Peace on Earth, Pop ends with this horrible, necrotic, trapped in a tomb, the world is going to end, apocalyptic song, Wake Up Dead Man. And I think with the response you two got to the album and with the response to the Pop Mart tour and how, they were obviously tired by the end of Pop Mart. They were tired of the criticism. They were tired of dealing with the massive stage. They were tired of pushing exploration at the expense of adoration. And All That You Can't Leave Behind feels like a very, very strong response to that. And Grace, to me, feels like a very, very strong response to Wake Up Dead Man. Whereas Wake Up Dead Man is about being buried in the dirt and about not having any help when you need it and about just the darkness and hoping someone will listen out there in the void. Grace is about possibilities and openness and light and opportunities and forgiveness. And I think to view the song on its own is to misinterpret what it is as a bookend to Wake Up Dead Man.
I agree. As much as I dissed it earlier.
So it's not a B-side.
It isn't. However, taken at face value, it very much feels that way. But it wasn't until reading what Bono had to say in YouTube by U2 about Grace interrupting karma and how Grace enters and turns karma upside down. That connection that you just made about Wake Up Dead Man very much makes that bookend, it almost redeems Wake Up Dead Man. It almost redeems the whole album of Pop if you want to really dig down deeper into this particular song closing out All That You Can't Leave Behind. Because in the end, grace and love are the things that you can't leave behind. Without grace, there isn't anything. And it happens to be one of Bono's favorite words.
Yeah. It's interesting that they didn't ever, at least according, I'm just on U2.com right now, but that they haven't ever performed it live. I'm sure there's got to be snippets that have been done.
I don't think they've even done a snippet.
No, interesting.
Yeah, I think it's completely gone. Yeah.
Yeah. U2GW in the chat room mentioned that we should have a show just on the last songs on albums. 40, MLK, Mothers of the Disappeared. All I Want Is You, Love Is Blindness, The Wanderer, Dead Man Grace, What, Yahweh. Which would be an interesting album just to listen.
Cool. Yeah, I like that idea.
Yeah, that is a good idea.
And there's similar themes of like song three being a certain theme or whatever. You know, you kind of look through that kind of idea of through the albums and sort of pick out, you know, opening songs and the third song and the last song or whatever. And I remember doing a bit of that sort of mixtape stuff back in the day. But I think it's a beautiful song that is probably doesn't get its due as well, but the way it sort of picks up and the sample that I happened to choose was just kind of before it started getting into it a little bit, and it's got a nice sort of swing to it, and any sort of, like I've said before, any chance to hear Bono either, I don't know if you call it emoting or getting that gravelly voice a bit and then changing to the higher register later on in the song is I'll happily listen to that, even if it is singing about New York or whatever.
Well, and I appreciate some of those songs. Like that Grace is a good example of a song that I can actually write to, because when I write, I like to have noise on. I'm not one of those people that wants it quiet. I just wasn't brought up that way. I worked in newsrooms when I was younger, and I like to write with noise, but it can't be noise that I'm too focused on, or else I won't focus on my writing. So I can't listen to City of Blinding Lights, for example, because I'll start singing it and then I'll want to go watch the video and then, you know, all that. But Grace is good enough that it's pleasant and quiet and peaceful, and I can just kind of doze out of it and into whatever I'm doing.
So it puts you to sleep, sort of.
In a way, yeah. It's definitely one of those that could be on my U2 sleep mixtape.
It's one of your lullabies.
And I have made one of those before. I mean, back in the days when we did make mixtapes, I had a sleep U2 mixtape.
Nice. All right. Well, anybody, any closing thoughts before we close out All That You Can't Leave Behind?
I think this album gets way too much grief. I think it was kind of U2's third big act, after the first one being Joshua Tree and the second one being Achtung Baby. It resonated with a lot more people than I think some diehard U2, especially 90s fans, want to give it credit for. And even though the lyrics weren't as heavy and the songs were more major key and the production was definitely more kind of stripped down. It's definitely one of their most important and influential albums, regardless of how well some U2 fans think it fits in with their overall catalog.
Yeah, it's kind of get the knock that it's them trying to go for radio airplay and trying, you know, is that sort of the bigger knock against it, that it's going for the commercial success as opposed to something like pop where they're taking more risks, or Actung even that?
Yeah, I think people thought that it played it safe.
Yeah.
I think people don't give enough credit to sheer song craft when they compare it with risk-taking and being adventurous in the music. I think both of those are extraordinarily important qualities to music, especially with a band like U2, a band that's as intelligent and talented as U2. And when people say that the only U2 that's worth it is when they're taking risks as opposed to when they're just trying to make really perfect singles and quality songs, it's one of the things that I see in fandom today that I don't have much patience for. They're two different qualities of U2, but they're two very important qualities of U2.
Mm-hmm.
I might be wrong on this, but I think this is the first album that the band released where the first four songs in the track list were singles off the album. So if you're going to listen to the album, you're going to hear all that familiar music right up front. But I also think that helps it when you're at shows. Those are the four songs that you get a lot of sing along with from the rest of the audience. So it's not just the diehards who can sing along. It's like three quarters of the arena or of the stadium, because you've heard these songs on the radio. You've grown up with these songs.
Isn't Joshua Tree the first? You got Streets, and then I Still Haven't Found, and With or Without You. What's the fourth?
Bullet.
Bullet.
Bullet. Okay.
Yeah, Bullet wasn't a single.
So Bullet wasn't a single. You're right. Okay.
We got fact checking right on the podcast. People don't even have to send in their comments.
Sorry.
No, it's good. As long as they listen long enough, I've heard other people stop the podcast to respond to an error, and they don't stick around long enough to hear the correction. But anyways.
Sherry, you ignorant U2 fan.
I'm glad you didn't say the word. I thought you were going to say the word. I was like, haven't you said enough?
I'm not Dan Aykroyd.
Marilyn, are you, Kaufman hasn't kicked in? Are you
there? Yeah, I'm still comments? Here.
Yeah.
Yeah. What I like about this album is it started their era of the super long album title. Before this album, all their albums had one or two words. And then the next three albums all had way too many words.
Larry figured out you can do smaller font sizes on shirts, and then it was okay.
Yeah, I guess he got
well, smaller shirt sizes for women, but I digress.
Yeah. And, the other thing about this album is this is when they really started doing those mid-tempo songs that they're really good at it, but there's really only two really jumpy rock songs on here. And the rest are fairly quiet. And that's why I like this album, because it's a salve to me. Like I like to listen to it when everything's chaotic, and then I put this on and I feel so much better about the world and myself. When, you know, because of those mid-tempo songs. So, and it's also the last album I feel like, and I know people are going to really hate when I say this, but it's the last album I feel like is like a full album, like what? The concept from beginning to end. Do you know what I mean? Like,
Ian might have issues.
You don't think Innocence is a concept album?
Well, now, but at the time, like when How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb came out, I thought that was a great collection of songs, but I don't really feel like it was a coherent album. And I felt the same way with No Line on the Horizon.
We'll talk about this in 2 weeks.
Right.
Save it for the podcast, Marilyn.
I'm kind of with Marilyn on that one. I'll back her up on that one. But
thanks, Chris.
All right. Well, let's before we step into hour two of the podcast, let's wrap things up. And yeah, like Sherry said, we'll save some of that discussion for a future episode. But if people do have follow-up comments, polite, nice comments and maybe some disagreements with things that were said, where can they find you guys, you folks on the interwebs? We'll start with you, Sherry.
At U2Com Sherry, as always.
And Marilyn?
Miss Marilyn.
And Ian. These are all on Twitter, I think, I'm assuming.
Twitter, yeah, sorry.
I know that, but yeah. Ian, how about you?
At Ian P. Ryan.
And Tasula.
At Tasula.
And I'm iChris, and you can follow the At U2 crew on Twitter at twitter.com/ATU2 and facebook.com/ATU2com. Next up, it will be How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb, and so be sure to stay tuned for that. We'll be back in a couple weeks recording that live. If you want to tune in, goodstuff.fm/live and join the awesome chat room. We had a huge group of people. Thanks to all of you for tuning in live. And if you want to send in comments for the podcast, you can tweet them at us using hashtag AskAtU2 and tweet any, doesn't matter, you can just tweet it out into the world and we'll grab that and use it in a future podcast. If you've got a question, a comment, maybe some thoughts on specific songs from How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb, and we'll interject those as we discuss. And I would love to hear your thoughts and what you loved, what you hate, what you don't care about. What's the song off How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb that you'll get up from the couch to actually skip or go back to repeat?
We want to hear all that you fashion, all that you make, all that you build, all that you break.
There you go. That's a great way to end this. Thanks once again to Simon Peta for the theme music that you're about to hear as we sign off. And we'll see you again next time. Thanks for listening. Have a great day. Bye.